This is the Zesty Garden, and it's our Tasty Trek segment with Darla and Michelle. Darla Bentley is a travel agent and has specialized in culinary travel, and Michelle De La Serta is an online food blogger. And today we're going to talk about organizing and having a garden party.
There are several ways that you can have a garden party. One of the most formal is the English garden party. It's also the most fun because you get to dress up and you get to send invitations. You will never, ever want to email, text, or Facebook the invitations to a traditional English garden party. Never. It's very important that this be done properly. You want to use white linens and beautiful tablecloths. You want flowers put in jars, kind of almost haphazardly, almost in a lazy way, but still very elegant. Put them in jugs or pitchers. You want flowers everywhere. Do it in the summertime, in the height of the blooming of your garden. You also want to have plenty of shade. So if you don't have a lot of shade trees, maybe get some canopies or something and set out. Never use plastic or paper or anything like that. You want to use glass and silver and beautiful plates, typically white, light colors. The fun part about this, like I said, is the dressing. And so, you know, wear gloves or hats or something that makes you feel like you're going to a traditional English garden party.
So this really is more than just a gathering. You're taking some time to do something that's really special.
It's an event, absolutely. A daytime party, you want to hang flags, or a traditional English party, you just take triangles of material and you hang them along your fence line or in the trees. You'll want to use flowers like primroses or geraniums or tea roses, something that's very traditionally British. You want classical music playing in the background. An evening affair would call for twinkle lights all over in the trees. They're called fairy lights, something that creates a mood.
When I'm hearing this, I'm thinking of, when you say twinkle lights and people gathered, it's almost like a reception. Can you mix the two together, or do you try to
Absolutely.
Leave them separate?
Absolutely. An English garden party reception is stunning. The dresses are gorgeous. Sometimes they're handmade with the big hats. They're absolutely beautiful.
And what sorts of things are served at a garden party?
The food at a traditional English garden party is going to be much different than any of the American counterparts. The food is going to be lighter. It's going to be dainty, finger size almost. Lots of cakes and pastries, but not always sweet. A lot of these things can be served savory. For example, smoked salmon, smoked trout with some horseradish wrapped in a lovely pastry, but tiny.
That sounds good to me, actually, more than the sweets
yes.
do.
But there's plenty of sweets. You're going to find lots of custards, tea cakes, which are just tiny little portion-sized delicious cakes. You're going to have a lot of sandwiches. But don't forget, with an English garden party, you must cut off the crust. No crust allowed.
Oh, come on.
On your cucumber sandwiches. That is a must. The queen herself would show up and tisk-tisk for crust on your English cucumber sandwich. Ham and cheese sandwiches are also very popular. And then your fruit tarts. Sometimes chocolate, but most of the time it's a lot of fresh fruits that are grown in that area. So
typically this is done in the evening. You were saying you could do something in the afternoon?
You could do an afternoon or an evening.
The foods will slightly change between your afternoon party to your evening party. If it's an evening party, people are looking more for a meal. So you are going to, instead of a tiny pastry with the smoked trout, you're actually going to have the full smoked trout with a cracker or something to go along with it. So the food will change slightly. The flavors will remain the same, but the quantities will change between your evening and your afternoon party.
Who gets invited to this?
Anybody you'd like.
Family,
friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's people you want to enjoy a wonderful evening with. But family and friends is typically who you'd want to invite over.
And how long does this usually last?
Anywhere from an hour and a half to 3 hours, depending on events. You can play games. If you do an afternoon party, you can play games in the yard.
Badminton, cricket, croquet. These are very popular games to play in the afternoon garden party.
So to me, this sounds more than just a garden party. It sounds like an English garden party.
Yes, this is very much.
Exactly. It's a very traditional. This specific one that we're talking about now is a very traditional British party.
Which is much different than, say, your Southern garden party. We've all seen Southern garden parties on TV, on different shows. And while there is many similarities between the English garden party, there's a slightly different feel. And the food is the major difference in your Southern garden party.
So what would you get in a Southern garden party?
Oh, you'd be having some fried chicken. You would be having the house wine of the South, which is your sweet tea. You'd also have unsweetened for those watching their sugar. You would have ham and cheese biscuits, ironically, just like you would in the British one. Your mint juleps, you'd have a lot more cocktails. You would want to have shrimp. Shrimp is required, whether you're going to do it on skewers, on toast, shrimp and grits, maybe served in a martini glass, so portioned out.
Spicy shrimp or?
Could be Cajun, okay. Depending on where you're at and where your tastes lie. But Cajun is definitely a nice feel to the party. For example, deviled eggs are incredibly popular. But doing Cajun deviled eggs just take your party up a notch.
Oh, that just sounds so good. Dang it, I haven't had lunch yet today, so I'm just salivating thinking of all these things.
And you can't forget your crab cakes and your mud pies and your greens. The Southerners love their greens. And, you know, you think of them at your dinner table, but they are very acceptable to have in your Southern garden party.
How do they have their greens? I had my grandmother's from Arkansas, and so is my great aunt, her aunt, that I got to know growing up, and she loved her mustard greens.
Mm-hmm. Tossed with bacon.
But turnip greens and beet greens. And so
basically, if it's green, they'll eat it.
Are they kind of braised?
Braised, sautéed. I prefer them sautéed. I don't like them overly boiled because then they become very limp and soggy and they lose everything. Flavor, everything is just washed out. I like them sautéed. With fat.
Does okra get served at these Southern parties?
Absolutely. Fried okra is a staple.
Fried is great.
Yes, it is.
Don't boil them.
No, they become, the texture is slightly different when they're boiled.
Slightly, yeah.
So.
Okay.
Well, with a Southern garden party, you're also going to dress for the event. You're going to have...
Now, do you just dress as the host or do you encourage all of your attendees to come?
When you create your invitation, you let them know the kind of dress that you're expecting. Is it going to be casual? Is it going to be a traditional dress? A traditional Southern garden party dress would be linen shirts and seersucker pants and sundresses for the ladies, maybe a floppy hat, definitely sunglasses during the day. You can also have them at night, of course, but again, the food would change slightly, not as much as it does with the English garden party, because the South has their staples are their staples at every meal. You want to definitely have some fans blowing, some, you know, at the perimeter, helps keep the bugs away, keep everybody kind of cool, have your canopies going. If you do an evening, make sure you have your citronella candles at the perimeter. You don't want people breathing it in, so put it at the perimeter and keeping the bugs away at that time. You want mason jars with candles in them or hanging in trees with the little lights in them. Again, twinkle lights in the trees and adorning the fences. Old coffee cans painted white with hydrangeas and mums and dahlias. Make sure that you have a lot of flowers. The key to the perfect garden party, no matter what the theme, are the flowers. That's the key right there. That's the most important part because it brings the warmth and the scent and the beauty above and beyond the dress and the food.
How would the flowers change from an English cottage garden party to Southern?
Well, an English garden party, you're doing roses and peonies and things that you would find in England, adorned maybe with some baby's breath. And they're going to be a little more haphazard. In a Southern party, you're just going to stuff those cans full of big hydrangeas and mums overflowing and maybe some fern for some green. So they do change a little bit.
So a lot of this you would have to plan for way ahead of time, too. If you wanted to grow some of these flowers, you would need to know, okay, I'm going to be doing my party on this date, which means I've got to back up at least this far and get things planted and started ahead of time, especially if you're doing a lot with planters.
Exactly. And if you wanted to do a Southern garden party wedding, you would definitely want to do it at the height of the blossoming season where your blooms are at their most beautiful.
Too bad we can't have jasmine growing outside here. That would be really
be
nice.
Wonderful. I grew up under my bedroom window with night-scented jasmine. Mm. And then I also had peach and orange trees, so those blossoms. So I just grew up in a very fragrant suburban area.
Mm. So what else would you include in a garden party? You mentioned the invitations. And usually, how many should, what's a manageable number?
That depends on your setting. How big is your yard? How big is your space?
How much money do you have?
That's right.
Yes, yeah. that's a factor. You can have a small intimate with, you know, maybe three other couples, so just eight of you. Or mm-hmm. you can have 35, or you could have 60. I mean, if you've got a plantation-style home, here in Cache Valley, people have larger yards. They can accommodate more people. But it's how intimate do you want it? Do you want everybody else mixing and mingling and you get to maybe half your guests? Or do you want to be able to have one-on-one time with all of your guests? And that's your choice. That's a matter of personal taste.
And I suppose it also depends on how much you want to show off. You know, if my garden, my vegetable garden is growing, I might want to have paths going out into the garden so people can just wander out and
absolutely line your paths with bags with lights in them so it's a well-lit walkway.
Okay. And what else would you include?
Well, one of the most popular garden parties right now is the indoor garden party. And oftentimes it's because it's either too hot or too cold outside. So you would take any flowers that you can get from any store that's selling them during the winter and fill your home with flowers. And it's really fun to add great big balloons and a lot of color. An indoor garden party is more casual. Feel free to email, Facebook, you know, use Facebook to create the invitations. Just make sure you get the RSVP. The indoor garden party is bright and colorful and warm and happy, especially if it's in the winter, because that's your time to pretend it's warm out, pretend it's spring, get together. The food is a little more festive and exciting and flavorful. Still should never use paper plates or paper cups. that should be...
Otherwise, you have a barbecue.
Exactly.
That should just be a rule in entertaining.
That should be a rule, except in barbecues.
Barbecues and tailgating, that's good for paper products.
You're going to have casual attire. If you do an evening, have the lights set to a more festive, almost tavern-like, and have some music playing so people can dance. Candles and maybe hurricane lamps on the counters. Just make it fun and exciting. Do whatever you want with it. Make sure it's colorful. Make sure it's happy, for sure. There's also themed parties. So if you're in the middle of winter, do Christmas in July. Crank up the air conditioning and have everybody bring their ugly sweater and have fun with it.
I'm also thinking of the flowers that you would have at an indoor party. You probably wouldn't want to have flowers that are too fragrant, because then they're starting to overcome. I'm thinking of if you brought lilacs inside, perchance. Lilacs are great smelling outside, and a few of them are okay inside, but if you've got this big bouquet, then it becomes more of a detractant.
Exactly. Some themes that you could do in the summertime would be like the Roaring Twenties, and that, you know, that could be costumed and exciting and fun. Have some, big band music playing.
With your indoor party, with your food, you have a lot more freedom with your menu. You're closer to the kitchen, your serving area, more warm foods are possible. But you still want to maintain that feel of an outdoor party. And so you're still going to want to stick with things like crab cakes and potato salads and pasta salads. Meat skewers are very popular. They're portable. You're going to want to serve, whether it's indoor or outdoor, you want things to be buffet style unless you have the funds to hire serving staff to walk around with the fancy trays serving your guests. But we'll go with buffet style, as that's the easiest. You're going to want to have more cocktails, more festive drinks, fruity, floral, using possibly edible flowers in some of the flavors, cheese plates, meat plates. You know, you're going to have those things that can be preserved longer by being indoors than they would outdoors.
I wanted to back up and talk about the invitation, because I have this pet peeve, and it revolves around RSVP. And it seems like most people have no idea that RSVP means to
please respond.
Please respond. Mm-hmm. So A, you don't say please RSVP because it's redundant. It's just very technical here. And the second thing is that respond, meaning whether you're going to come or not, if you're asked to RSVP, you're supposed to call and let them know whether you're going to be there or not, not just if you're going to come. Correct?
Exactly. The solution is to have a little card, have a little envelope with your address and a stamp on it, because many times people will not go and get a stamp, or they'll forget, or they'll set it aside. But if it's already stamped with your address on it, the card will say, yes, I am coming, no, I am not, I respectfully decline, or something like that. I have that exact same pet peeve.
If you wanted to save the cost of sending a second mailer out, you know, that smaller invitation, you could take it upon yourself to send out an email and to all of your guests, maybe 2 to 3 days after they would have received the invitation, and then specifically say, John, are you and Mary going to be able to join us for blah, blah, blah party? And then usually they'll just hit reply and you get your answer. That's a more modern way of getting a response, not as elegant as the fancy card, but I have been guilty of forgetting to even send that self-addressed stamped card.
And so that's
back.
Kind of nice to get something that allows it an easy mm-hmm. way to respond.
An easy way to respond, because people don't respond. I think there's a certain mentality here in Utah. They're used to wedding receptions where you just kind of drop in. It's from 7 to 9, and you drop in, and you say hello to the bride and groom, and you drop off your gift, and you get a piece of cake. And so I think some of that formalness has been lost, and it's not part of the culture here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Growing up in Southern California, if you were invited somewhere, you needed to reply. Even if it was to a 5-year-old's birthday party, you still gave an RSVP. And so I think Utah needs to do a little bit better. That's part of our culture here that we probably should work on. But for any type of thing that you've been invited to, you should always respond with an RSVP.
Where do people go for information about hosting a garden party? Do you have your favorite sites that you like to go to?
My favorite resource is Martha Stewart. She is elegant. She is put together. She is classical. She knows how to be casual in the most elegant way.
Well, I love Martha as well. I'm also a fan of epicurious.com. They have a wealth of information, particularly on the food aspect. That's where my expertise is, so I spend a lot of time researching on their site.
Okay, great. We've been talking about hosting a garden party and the things to do and the things to think about. This is the Tasty Trek module with Darla and Michelle. Darla Bentley is a travel agent and has specialized in culinary travel. And Michelle De Lacerda is an online food blogger. Thank you so much for both of you for joining me today. We'll have you on again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In this next part of our program, have you ever thought about bonsai plants? Well, I haven't. And so when the topic came up, we did some searching around to find an expert. And who better than to talk to than the president of the Bonsai Club of Utah, Aaron Penrod. Aaron, thank you for joining me on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
This is a live interview, and would like to open it up to our listeners. If you have any questions or comments, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page, and you'll see the Zesty Garden posted there at the top, and you can send in your question or comment there. So what exactly is bonsai? In my research on this, Aaron, it's not what I thought it was.
Bonsai originally started in China as a means of bringing plants down from the mountains for medicinal purposes, and then it kind of transitioned into enjoyment. The Japanese took it and really refined it and kind of turned it into an art, and it actually translates to tree in a pot. So a lot of people have a misconception about bonsai, and they think that it's a juniper in the mall or something, because that's what they see. But really, in Japan, it's a very high art form, and it's kind of exploding in the U.S. right now, which is exciting.
Well, and I know for many, they might think of bonsai as being the type of tree, but bonsai is not the tree. That's just the art form.
Yes. You can use any variety of tree or woody shrub, even woody perennials, as long as they're deep in size.
Aaron?
Yes.
says we're losing you, so I think we're going to try and call you back and see if we can get a better connection.
Sure.
I'll just talk here for just a moment. So bonsai is, as I was learning on the internet, is about 2,000 years old. And as Aaron was saying, it was started in China, and I found it's been in Japan for about 1,000 years. And what I've liked about bonsai is that it's not necessarily just a miniature plant. It's not a dwarf plant. It's taking a plant that could get to larger sizes and go to a smaller size. And Aaron Penrod is the president of the Bonsai Club of Utah. And I love that bonsai, it's two characters that means planted in a shallow container. And how to take care of bonsai, we can go through all of that when we have Aaron back on the line. And are you back, Aaron?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. That sounds much better. So so let's talk about the types of plants that you would use in bonsai. They're not what most people, I think, would think. I did. They're not dwarfs. You're taking plants that can grow to full size and keeping them in miniature?
Yes. As I was saying before, you want to use a plant that has the ability to reduce its leaf size or already has small leaves. That is probably the most important aspect, so you can keep the tree so it looks like a large in a pot. The scale and ratio of the size is all complementary to each other. You would not want to use a tree like a catalpa, which has really, really big leaves. It just does not look right when you get to the finished state of a bonsai tree. But you can use any sorts of shrubs. And in fact, the most highly prized trees and things to use are collected from nature. It's extremely difficult nowadays to get permits to go very many places, but there are some places here in Utah and around the U.S. where people get permits to go collect, 500-year-old junipers and shape them to look like an ancient tree, which they already are, but to refine the foliage and make them beautiful. And you can use Japanese maples and elms and boxwood and pretty much anything you can grow in your yard, you could bonsai.
So any woody perennial?
Yes. And there's also an aspect of bonsai called kusamono, which is an accent plant. And you show your tree with an accent plant, you're trying to create a scene in nature. For instance, maybe you had a big tooth maple, which is a native of Utah. You would also want to show some sort of perennial or grass that grows with that tree in nature, like a hookera or some kind of phlox or something. You can even do the perennials in the smaller pots. It's really a much larger part of gardening than I think a lot of people realize. I've been doing it for quite a long time, and I still feel like I'm a beginner the deeper I delve into it.
Yeah. Well, so how did you start as a beginner? Because it can seem like it's somewhat overwhelming, but again, from what I've been reading online, it doesn't have to be.
Yes. I started when I bought my first house. I wanted to have a nice yard, so I got into gardening, and I eventually went to a nursery called Ben's House of Bonsai, which is sadly no longer around, and it just blew me away. It can be overwhelming when you're trying to achieve what a master has taken a long time to do. So I think it's important that people start out with younger material, that you don't go out and spend a ton of money and end up killing a tree, because that's what happens a lot of the time. A pot is very different from growing a tree in the ground. There's a lot of different factors you have to take into consideration, and even the masters still kill trees, so anybody out there that tries, do not get discouraged, because eventually you have a lot of success, and then your yard is filled with trees.
When you're looking to get started, should Well, should you just go and buy something in the store, or should you go and look outside? What are you looking for?
For a beginner, I would recommend either buying a tree that's from a local nursery that's already considered what we call pre-bonsai, where it's maybe been planted in a pot or some shaping has already been done to it. For people who want to take the more artistic approach and create a tree from nothing, nursery stock is by far the best way to go. 5-gallon nursery stock. If I go to the nursery and I'm looking for something that I want to style and prune, I look for some feature of the tree that catches my eye, maybe nice soft movement, some curves, good roots showing on the surface, which makes the finished bonsai look stronger, like an aged tree. Healthy, of course. So there's a lot of different things you can do to get started, and I personally recommend starting with an easier species such as juniper or elm. Ficus is a great indoor tree, and that's also a big misconception too, is people think that they are indoor trees, and traditionally they are not. They are outdoor trees. All my trees are displayed on pedestals and benches around my yard and kind of incorporated into my garden.
So most of yours are for outdoors. How does that change if you wanted for indoor bonsai?
Indoor trees you just have to take a little bit more care. They need good light. A big problem here in Utah is humidity in the house, especially in the winter, is really, really low. Got your heater running. So it poses a few more challenges, in my opinion. There's a lot of people that grow almost exclusively indoor trees, and that's kind of their thing. You know, there's a lot of different types of trees people get into. I tend to gravitate more towards conifers. I like the really rugged look with dead wood swirling around the live wood veins.
Mm.
You can do it either way, but I've just found for myself that it's easier to grow the outdoor trees that you don't have to fuss, and they're easy to water and easier to feed, et cetera.
Okay, and we have a question from Keith in St. George. Hi, Keith. How can we help?
Hi. I just wanted to mention that years ago, Sunset Magazine had a really good article on how to do small trees from start. And they ran it's a starvation type where you actually make a mold, stick a potato in it to make the right size, and then you just put an apple or an apricot or anything in there and deprive it of nutrients, and it works really well. So that article came out of Sunset, and, then it's telling you how to take care of it like he is, but for a beginner, that was cheap and easy.
And so what type of tree did you end up growing?
Well, I ended up moving twice, so they didn't grow very well, but it was fun to try. So, and I tried junipers, transplanting them, like you said, getting them out of the wild, and they don't work at all. At least they didn't work for me, but I'd still like to do it, but somebody's got to have a lot of attention to detail in their life, make them work.
Well, thanks for your call, Keith.
All right, thank you, bye.
Take care. So, Aaron, how long does it take to really get a bonsai to where you want it? I mean, you've always got the maintenance because the tree's going to continue to grow, although yep. smaller because it's in that container. But how long does it get from point A to point Z, if you will?
So that depends on the age of tree you have. Of course, as Keith, starting a tree from seed or even a cutting it takes a long time. And what we do as bonsai growers is, he had mentioned starving the tree, and that's another misconception. I feed my bonsai trees probably 10 times as often as I do my lawn, and I feed my lawn 5 times a year. We're constantly feeding and pushing a lot of growth to keep the trees vigorous. And so if you have an older tree that's collected from the wild, which by the way, I don't recommend to beginners because there are a lot of to keep the tree alive, and that's why he said it's so difficult. There's a lot that you need to know. But anyway, if you're starting with an old tree, say a 200-year-old tree, they grow at a much slower rate, and they take a long time to develop a lot of ramification, and I'm talking upwards of 10 years to get a fully developed what we call pad. But a younger tree, it can be done in as little as 3 or 4. And it does take a long time because you're waiting for the tree to grow and you're pruning off, the extensions that are coming out to get further back budding on the tree. So it does take a little time. And I want people to know that that shouldn't discourage you either, because you can either have a well-developed bonsai in 5 years or finally get started in 5 years. And so it is a labor of love, and it is something that I'm going to do until I die, is just further develop every tree that I have. And it's really a labor of love.
I liked what I found online. There are different types of bonsai, and they are based on the number of men that it takes to move the pot. And what information do you have for someone who's wanting to get started? What resources would you suggest? I'm sure you must have, your club must meet at least on a monthly basis.
Yes, we do. We meet once a month every fourth Wednesday at the Sugar House Garden Center, and that's on 2100 South and 1610 East. It's just at the northeast corner of Sugar House Park. We meet at 7 o'clock. During the spring and summer months, we try to have workshops once a month, on the second Saturday. And the club is by far the best way in the valley to learn bonsai. Several of the members, including myself, have traveled out of state and studied with masters in California and Oregon. And we actually are bringing in a guy from Tennessee who studied in Japan for a while to further help us. If you're just looking to get material and kind of do it on your own, you can go to any nursery and get nursery stock. But there are a couple specialty nurseries in town that do sell, finished bonsai, Paradise Palms and Cactus and Tropicals. And Western Gardens also has tools. And there's a Baja Pottery, it's changed to Home and Garden Pottery on State Street and 80-something South. So there are quite a few places around. But if you want really good information on care and technique, the club is the best way to go. And people can also look us up on Facebook, the Bonsai Club of Utah.
Great. Well, Aaron, thank you so much. I appreciate you joining me today on the program.
Hey, thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden, and we've been talking about bonsai. Aaron Penrod is president of the Bonsai Club of Utah. Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to have a quick break here, but then we're also going to have an interview, The Right Size Flower Garden, and I'll be talking with author Carrie Ann Mendez, so stay tuned. Welcome back to the second part of our program. I have a couple of community calendar items for the gardening calendar. Tonight at 6 p.m., there's an invasive pest workshop in the Cache County Administration Building, and it's in the multipurpose room. The workshop will focus on identifying the spotted winged Drosophila and brown marmorated stink bug. No registration is required. And there will be a nature walk at the Swanner Preserve in Park City on Saturday from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Learn about wetland science, native plant and animal species, and the history of the Swanner Preserve. These tours take place on generally flat terrain and are appropriate to anyone that is relatively active. Information is at SwannerEcoCenter.com. And then there's also a 5-part landscape design series each Thursday in April from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ogden Botanical Gardens. Learn how to draw, design, and choose the right plant material for your landscape. Cost and registration information is at usubotanicalcenter.org. And if you have an item for our gardening calendar, please send it along to zestygarden@gmail.com. Next, I'm going to talk with Carrie Ann Mendez. She's the author of the new book, The Right Size Flower Garden. Carrie, thank you for joining me on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, as I found with this book, it seems to be a book more about simplification rather than expansion.
Yeah, I think so. Simplification being in maintenance. I mean, gosh, if you want to expand your gardens using these tough love, low maintenance plants, go for it. But for me, and I think for a number of us, we started to feel like we're becoming slaves to our gardens as life changes. And my purpose was to write a book that would be able to rein in the garden to match our time and ability now at this phase of our life, wherever you are in your garden life. And also, equally, if not more importantly, make the gardens more sustainable. So much less water requirements, less fertilizer, all these things. As we're going to be tweaking our gardens, let's make sure that we're keeping the right plants and practices in mind.
So being smart with what you have and what you decide to put in.
Well, so what I mean by this, if I understand that correctly, so plants that I had put in over the years, some of them may have been foggish, you know, because they were a gift from a friend and I couldn't say no. I love free things. And then I realized that the bee balm, for instance, might be just sweeping over the entire garden. And that's a plant that needs to be either put in a container or escorted out of my garden. I always remind people in this book is that our plants are not our children or pets. And so, therefore, if a plant really isn't performing the way we want them to, it's just too much of a hassle at this point, then we need to feel flexible enough to just pop it out of the ground and give it to a friend or donate it to a plant sale or do something else with it versus that we have to keep making excuses for a plant that is just not giving us happiness or it's just requiring way too much water or is really prone to disease or insect damage, all these other things.
Now, I help. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. I'm guessing.
No, I'm just. I found that many gardeners just have gotten to the point where they put up with plants because we tend to be garden nurturers. Mm. I mean, we're nurturers by habit, and we love plants. We love to grow them and see them and enjoy them and have them beautify our landscape and benefit the environment. But we also make a lot of excuses for plants that really aren't great plants, and we should not have put them in our garden, or they don't belong there now. And I hope I get people to, you know, to step out and make it and move, do something different with that garden if it's not bringing in the pleasure it used to.
Well, it's hard to kill something. You know, I've got my mother's green thumb, and I just hate to pull something out. Now, I've learned the hard way, and I've gotten past that with my iris because I grow a lot of tall bearded iris. That if I don't like it, I'm going to pull it out because there's another one ready to come in behind it.
Exactly. But you know what? I didn't use the word kill, Brian. I used the word that, gosh, if it's not fit for my garden, I can simply take that little orphan. You know, I've got my, the wonderful dogs and everything I've gotten from shelters, all my rescue dogs. Well, I can offer that little plant to somebody else so that they can take it and nurture it and love it. So I'm not necessarily throwing it in the compost pile.
Well, isn't that perpetuating the problem? If it's a problem in your...
Well, not mine. No, I shouldn't say that. Sorry.
Okay.
I would hope that at least we would give a fair warning if there's something about that plant that we're giving away. We should certainly not be blindsiding the person with maybe something they need to be aware of about the plant. So,
now, in your first chapter, it's titled, Help, My Garden Has Taken Me Hostage. How do you know you've been taken hostage? Because if you're like me, you're kind of a denier that you've got too much. You've always got room for more. So how do you get over that?
Well, I mean, if you're starting to feel guilty that you're not spending time in the garden, that you wanted to go perhaps do something with a friend or with a family member or whatever, and you're starting to feel guilty because your garden is demanding your time versus you really doing something you really want to enjoy, if guilt is starting to drive the way you're thinking about your garden, you've been taken hostage by your garden because the garden is commanding your time. It should be the other way around. We need a garden that fits into our time frame and lifestyle. And the original title of this book was The Downsized Flower Garden, but we changed it because for many people, they're not going to change the square footage. They're happy with the size of the garden. But because it's more work than they want, we need to do some switcheroos with the plant material in there so that they do have more time and actually more beautiful gardens at the same time.
I like that you also begin with weeds, getting the weeds under control. And what was it you called some of them, or even plants that you enjoy can be like a weed. They play the red light, green light game where you turn and look at them and they're not doing anything, but then you look away and then look back again and all of a sudden they've moved 50 feet.
No. Well, don't you feel that? I mean, gosh, how many of us have not put B-bomb let's use the word mint for a second and look at what it's done, gooseneck, some of these plants that are adorable in little pots. They just call it for our heart, on our heartstrings. And then we put them in the garden, and this plant, you know, it'll follow you in the house if you don't slam the door fast enough. And it's not that that's a bad plant. That's a plant that maybe belongs in a meadow garden or in an area with other equally aggressive plants that can just fill in that spot and look beautiful. But if the expectation is it's going to stay in that 1 foot by 1 foot square in my little well-designed garden, then we're fooling ourselves and it becomes a hassle.
Well, this is The Zesty Garden. You're listening to an interview with Carrie Ann Mendez. She's the author of The Right Size Flower Garden from St. Lin's Press. And we've got about 5 minutes left. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also post a question or comment at the Utah Public Radio Facebook page or send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So I can't help this. You keep bringing up Monarda, and I'm like, I love Monarda. Maybe I love it so much because I have it more on the north side of my house. It doesn't give a lot of sun, so then it doesn't spread so much.
Exactly. Well, that's a great way to deal with plants, as you just said, that are fast spreaders, is put them in an area that's more stressful for them. So give them an area that's not ideal. Now you have created a way of keeping them in shock, and that's great. And you know, this is the other thing I do. If there's a plant I love, let's say obedient plant, Physostigia, that can be pretty aggressive. So, but I love that plant, the late season color in my perennial garden. Well, if I can get the variegated variety of that plant, like variegata, then because it has less chlorophyll, green, it's got more variegation, it doesn't have the food-producing ability to make it as aggressive in my garden. So now I've used a plant that by nature, because of the variegation or more gold or yellow in the plant, it doesn't spread as fast because it doesn't have the ability to do so. It doesn't have the photosynthesis ability at the same level. So I've naturally taken a plant that would have been a fast spreader, and because of the variegation, I've got a plant that's, now you're really behaving. You're really kind of staying in a much slower pace. I like this. So I do that sometimes. I just switch a variety within that aggressive plant family to one that is much less of a spreader.
I wish I had a variegated comfrey plant because I love the blossoms and what it does for the bumblebees, but yikes, if I didn't have it in a bucket, it would be all over the place.
But wait a minute, you've got to try Axminster Gold. Have you done that?
No. Axminster Gold?
It is stunning. It's called Axminster, Axminster Gold. It's got this brilliant chartreuse and kind of a blue-green variegated leaves. It is a knockout. It has the beautiful, so-so flowers for the bees, which is important. But it is striking, and it's vase-shaped. It's stunning. It stays in one spot. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you. I'm definitely going to look that one up. I also love how in the book you encourage some whimsy. I saw a photo of a fence that all it is skis. And I loved the filing cabinet in the back, and the drawers are pulled over, open almost all the way at the bottom and just a little bit at the top, and you've got plants in there.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to have fun. I mean, and that picture I took of the skis was on Martha's Vineyard in this beautiful area. That was a house overlooking the water with all these different skis, there's water equipment and all that. And there is this fence I just cracked up. I loved it. I said, I love this guy, the guy's sense of amusement and love. And he's got his privacy, but he did it in a very unique, fun, personal way. And I love that. I think that's great. We've got to have fun when we garden. That's part of the joy, why we're doing it, is to also be able to amuse ourselves and have fun.
Well, I hate to do this because there's way too many more questions that I have for this, but we're running out of time. This is The Right Size Flower Garden, and Carrie Ann Mendez is the author, and the book is available from St. Lin's Press. Thank you so much for joining me today, Carrie.
Thank you very much, Brian. Have a good rest of the afternoon.
You too. Coming up next is Petals and Prose, and you'll learn about kumquaticide.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. I'd like to read several chapters over the next few weeks from a book called A Garden of Marvels by Ruth Kassinger. I will read just a little bit of her introduction to this book. This book was born of a murder I committed. It was not my first, but I have some hope that it will be my last, since I never set out to kill. Quite the contrary, I suppose I'm guilty only of negligent homicide, or possibly mere criminal negligence. Still, I feel deeply culpable. All I can do is plead ignorance and say that this particular death was a life-changing event for me, as well, of course, as for my victims. Possibly, since you have this book in your hands, the tragedy will save a few lives I will never know. The deceased in this case was a 12-year-old guest, a permanent resident, really, of our household. She was a lovely, graceful creature, about 5 feet tall, and a particular favorite of my family. Cam Quat, she would have been called. We lived just outside Washington, D.C. We knew her as a kumquat tree. In summer, she lived outdoors on our patio in a cobalt blue pot. From late fall through winter and into spring, she lodged in a small conservatory attached to the side of our house. I carried out the murder, and I can't help feeling her death deserves that name, in the conservatory with clippers. The facts are as follows. I brought my kumquat tree home as a 3-year-old, an immigrant from a nearby nursery. She was a slender thing in her gracile limbs, covered in deep green oval leaves, lifted upward and curved slightly outward, as if their weight were just a bit more than her youthful frame could bear. The following spring, she blossomed, flushing with tiny white fragrant flowers. In a week or so, the flowers fell, revealing dark green beads at their bases. These gradually expanded and finally ripened into golden orange fruits the size of large grapes. Plucked off the tree and eaten in one bite, the fruit had a slight bitterness, redeemed by the sweetness of the delicate peel. Even our terrier liked them and ate any that dropped to the floor. Every year, for 5 years, the tree grew a few inches taller, and her limbs branched again and again until she wore a dense and glossy crown. At 9, though, she stopped growing. I was relieved, actually, since the conservatory is crowded in the winter after I bring in the orange, lemon, fig, coffee, bay laurel, loquat, and banana tree, and a host of potted herbaceous plants. The following winter, however, she began to decline. The lower leaves on her branches turned yellow, and one after another fell to the stone floor with a delicate rattle. By early spring, when I moved her outside again, she held her skinny arms to the sky. Only their very ends were leafy, as if she were wearing nothing but green gloves. Was this a winterizing problem? I'm a lackadaisical gardener, so I tried to be more conscientious with my watering can. Was she hungry? I sprinkled her soil with fertilizer pellets. I repotted her in a larger container. Nothing helped. I looked to Ted, my husband, a more accomplished gardener, for inspiration. We have a strict division of labor for our household. I take care of the indoor plants. Ted tends to the outdoor ones. Years ago, he planted a crepe myrtle just outside a living room window, and early every spring before its new leaves appear, he prunes its multiple trunks back to the windowsill height. About the same time, he raises the head of one of our rose bushes that line our driveway, reducing them to 2-foot-high stubble. Miraculously, to my mind, within weeks, all the plants leaf out. By mid-May, we have rosebuds hectic with red blooms. In July, the crepe myrtle is weighted with magenta flowers that seem to be a lesson for me. I broke out the clippers and gave my kumquat a really thorough pruning, and then I put her outside in the sun and waited. Her branches turned brown and brittle. I had killed her. Why? Why did she succumb when the crepe myrtle thrived? It occurred to me I had run up against some fundamental biological difference between crepe myrtles and kumquat trees, but I had no idea what it was. This failure brought to mind other local botanical mysteries. Some friends up the street had a beautiful hickory. During our construction project, they added a deep layer of soil to their yard, and although they constructed a tree well around the trunk, the tree died. Why? Why does the vibrant green fescue in our lawn inevitably lose ground to scraggly, tough crabgrass? Why do houseplants so beautiful and vigorous in the garden center decline after a few weeks at home, even if I tend to them like a robin doting on her newly hatched chicks? Most immediately, I had two tree-sized dracaenia, those foolproof foliage plants ubiquitous in offices and shopping malls, whose roots had grown through drainage holes in pots and now circled their saucers. Could I safely prune these ugly outliers? I knew the basic rules of caring for indoor plants. Drain any water in plant saucers. Let the top inch of soil go dry before watering. Apply fertilizer in spring. But I realized I understood very little about how roots, stems, leaves, and flowers function, what physical and chemical processes make them work. In other words, I knew almost nothing about the physiology of plants. How could I know so little? Here's one excuse. I'm a suburbanite. I live in a house with a yard the size of a carpet remnant. Yet where I live, oak trees drop acorns, daffodils bloom, and grass, or crabgrass, grow. But vegetation here is a minor component of a landscape dominated by man-made features like houses, streets, and cars. Until I took up indoor gardening, the only thing I pondered about plants was which ones to eat. And she goes on to say that actually the study of plants came into prominence later than the study of the biology of the body. And so we're a little behind in knowing about plants. Anyway, I intend to read more from this charming book. I hope you'll listen in. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.